The capital was supposed to have been located in Tucson. Did everybody know that? In fact, even Prescott and Yuma were even considered at the time. Phoenix was the last place that anybody wanted the capital to be. Tucson was more habitable, it had more money, but politics prevailed, and the capital was given to Phoenix in exchange to help with the constituency in Tucson who are a little burned now by brand new Arizona statehood politics. The land grant that the federal government gave to every state entering the Union to build a university was given to Tucson, and it becomes the University of Arizona. There was a college founded in 1886 in a distant Phoenix suburb that you had to take a ferry across the Salt River at Mill Avenue in order to get to it, Tempe. It was called the Tempe Normal School. By 1946, it was renamed Arizona State Teachers College, Tempe, to differentiate it between the Arizona State Teachers College in Flagstaff. By 1953, statewide ballot, the state of Arizona had voted that Arizona State Teachers College, Tempe, would become Arizona State University. Its athletic teams were known as the Normals, the Owls, and the Bulldogs. But when it became a university, they thought a new mascot should come with the new status. Apocrypha has it that somebody in the administration just uttered these words in a meeting one day. Why not just call them the Sun Devils? 2 years later, a former Disney animator designed the logo. This is Sparky. Now, former Disney animator is kind of funny because it's been told that he left Disney for creative differences, and the other was that he'd been fired by Walt Disney himself. And he had the opportunity to kind of get back at Walt by making Sparky's face look a little bit like Walt's. Now, he'd be known as a Sun Devil, but let me ask you, when you think of things that could be truly satanic, is this what you think of? I know if you're a U of A fan, you do. But this little cute guy? I don't think so. What's funny, though, is I can remember I went to a prayer meeting at my very first church. I went to have a prayer meeting, and I was wearing an ASU shirt, and Sparky was on the front. And when you're in Northern California, and nobody knows the story behind this, we sat down at prayer meeting and just had this sweet saint, she stared at this shirt the entire time. I couldn't figure out why she was staring at this shirt. But it was funny because it looked like a devil. El Diablo, the devil. The Arizona Diocese thought so. In 1987, when they brought the Pope to Arizona, he said Mass at Sun Devil Stadium. They covered every image of Sparky with sheets. By the way, doused Sun Devil Stadium in holy water, courtesy of the Tempe Fire Department, too. So I don't think of this when I think of that which is satanic. I also don't think of pentagrams or heavy metal music or sacrifices using goats or anything. And I really feel uncomfortable with the picture of people putting forward that this is what it means to be satanic. Because I feel uncomfortable because the average person watching would use this definition and it would be a victory for Satan, a real victory for Satan, I believe. Let me ask you, does being satanic require any ceremony? Does being satanic require some sort of blood sacrifice? Does being satanic need an image like this? Cloven hooves and a tail and horns and a pitchfork to come at you in order for us to recognize that which is satanic? And of course, the answer is what? The answer is no. The answer is absolutely not. What would you define as satanic? What does the Bible define as satanic or being like Satan? I told you that we would finally come to this character, if you will, this main character in the book of Job. We studied God, what we know of God himself from the book of Job. We studied last week of what we know about Job himself. And then we have to come to this character if we're going to be at all loyal or honest to the scriptures. Satan. So what we learned about Job is that he's, what we learned about God is that he's truly in charge. Forgetting his love and mercy, though, while remembering that absolute sovereignty and that power leads to heresy. Leads us to misunderstanding who God is completely. Human suffering does not mean that God, who is in charge, no longer has love or mercy for us, when we know for a fact that he does. He loves us in our suffering. He may love us more because of our suffering. And sometimes we don't even realize that we love God until we come through our suffering. Job taught us that the true worship of God will have nothing to do with earthly blessing or suffering. True worship takes place even when every earthly blessing for doing so has either been reversed or removed. Could we worship God if we truly pictured him as our enemy, as Job does? Job holds God personally responsible for everything that is happening to him, and yet he can still say, "Naked I came, naked I'll go. Blessed, the Lord gives, the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." Job can still worship when there's absolutely no earthly reason to do so. He worships him simply because he is God. So, when we come to Satan, we begin here. There was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. The sons of God. Scholars will tell you that the character of Satan has not been developed in the Old Testament as it was in the New Testament. By the time New Testament comes around, Satan is actually a person. He's actually a being. He can be recognized. He's told. He has many names, and he's given a tag, a serpent, so forth and so on. He's seen in prophetic visions. He is recognized as actually confronting Jesus himself. But in the Old Testament, he's still much more of a, I guess, an idea, if you will. A symbol, if you will. So for a book this old, a tale as old as Job, to actually recognize him as a human, it's actually not human, but as a form, as a person, as someone who has an identity, it's actually quite fascinating. So Satan shows up. Satan is always a proper name in the Bible. In fact, it is there. You know, whenever I see it, I take away the capital S. I don't think he deserves a capital in front of his name. Because the name actually is not a name. The name is the Hebrew word of what he is. Satan. Adversary or accuser. That's the name that's given to him in the Old Testament simply because that is what he does. Remember, Hebrew usually observes an action and then assigns a word to the action. The action comes first. So from the first time that we see him in the garden, he's acting as something. He is Adam and Eve's adversary. He is their accuser, if you will. And he's always been God's accuser. So the Old Testament writers gave him the name Satan. But again, it's not a proper name. It's just a word for adversary, enemy, or accuser. So I always like to take the capital out. But this was actually a translation of the Bible, and I'm not going to mess with that. I will tell you, Microsoft Word will not let you not capitalize it. Just telling you. You put out Satan in a small S, it will automatically autocorrect it and capitalize it. Macintosh doesn't, by the way. I'm just saying. This is what he is. In the Old Testament, this is what he is. This word is used 28 times in the Hebrew Scriptures in the Old Testament. 28 times. And there are only 3 occasions when it actually refers to this guy. Only 3 occasions. All 25 other times, it's used in its lexical form, if you will. It's used in its dictionary form. And it describes anybody who's an adversary of anybody. So it's only used 3 times to identify the devil himself. One here in Job. One in Zechariah, when Joshua the high priest is standing and Satan is standing beside him. Again, I don't think it's saying his name. It's what he's doing to the high priest in Zechariah. Remember, he's accusing him. Beautiful image, though, by the way. Beautiful image. Satan standing next to the high priest, dressed in filthy clothes. And by the high priest is representative of all who? All humanity. He's our guy, the high priest. He represents all of us. He's interceding on behalf of all of us. He represents all of humanity. He's standing there in filthy rags, and Satan is looking at God saying, "See? See?" And God answers, "You think you know him? You think you know who he is? I really know who he is. And he's my son. And I'll remove the rags that you've accused him of, and I will clothe him in righteousness." It's a beautiful, beautiful prophecy in Zechariah. It's also used in 2 Chronicles 21:1. In Numbers 22, the angel of the Lord is called Satan because he's Balaam's adversary. So you get what I'm saying? You get what I'm getting at? To call him Satan, to give him a name, is much more of a New Testament way of looking at him than the Old Testament way of looking at him. And by the Bible writer calling him Satan here, I'm not so sure that in Old Testament ways that he's actually giving him any credit for actually being an actual personage, if you will. It's hard. It's hard to classify him because I know he's not human. I know he's not natural. Anybody here agree that Satan is a supernatural being? He can inhabit bodies. He doesn't need one to exist. He can inhabit bodies. He once was an angel of God. Now he's considered a fallen angel. And I don't know what angels are made up of, but I know that they're not like me. So the question is, does he belong here? Does he belong at this meeting? Because God does something with this Son of God that he doesn't do with any of the other sons of God. He calls him out and says, "Where did you come from? Where did you come from?" Satan answered the Lord and said, "From roaming about on the earth and walking around on it." Was he once a citizen of heaven? Was he once a son of God? Yeah. Second in command. Sometimes we forget that. The Father, the Son, Lucifer, the Son of the Light, firstborn of all angels, first created of all angels, in charge, absolutely in charge. But being cast out, again, there's still something like him. He's not natural like you and me. He has power that's beyond capability, our capability. And I don't know how he did it, but he arranged to crash this meeting. I know that if I wanted to attend a meeting in heaven, I don't think I could get there. But he's clearly singled out as someone who no longer belongs. Where did you come from? So Satan says, "I've been walking to and fro. I can go wherever I want." And when he says, "I can go wherever I want," where I can go wherever I want, there's a hint that Satan wasn't given any other domain except at the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Who was in charge of the garden? Adam and Eve, right? Well, something happened at the fall because obviously the one who was in charge, the superintendent, the boss of the entire garden or of creation, all of a sudden now gives Satan permission to walk beyond the tree because now he's no longer bound there. Now he can go wherever he wants. We gave him permission to do that. And when we did that, we put him in charge. So that's why he thinks he belongs at the meeting. I'm in charge of the earth. They gave it to me. I took it from them. The first opportunity that they had, you, O great God of heaven, they turned on you and they turned to me. So I'm walking wherever I want to go. And of course, what does God answer to that? Have you considered my servant Job? Well, there's no one on earth like him, a blameless and upright man, fearing good, turning away from evil. God says to him, you've boasted that you're doing such a good job, that you're in control to and fro, but there are some places where you obviously still are not sovereign. Some hearts, have you considered Job? Then of all the descriptions that you've ever come up with, that you've ever imagined, that you've seen Hollywood try to imagine, or that you've seen people write books about, or anything that we would understand, what happens next will tell you all you need to know about what it means to be satanic. What happens next is what Satan says to reply to this. This is the definition of what it means to be truly satanic, to be an adversary, to be an accuser. Does Job serve God for nothing? That question right there. That's all you need to know about him. Here's where the adversary or the enemy becomes the accuser. Here's where he lives out his name. Does Job serve God for nothing? He accuses on two levels. He's going to accuse God, so he accuses God on a divine level, and he also accuses on a creator, a creature level. He also accuses Job himself. Look at the divine part. He tells God, he says, look, have you not made a hedge about him in his house and all that he has on every side? You've blessed the work of his hands and his possessions, have increased in the land. But put forth your hand now and touch all that he has. He will surely curse you to your face. He accuses God of not being worthy of true worship. That's worship for no other reason except that he is God. Job only worships God for what he can get out of the deal. People only follow God, according to one commentator, because they get something out of it. In Satan's view, God resembles a mafioso with a kept woman. Not a devoted wife or a politician who can win a fixed election. A priest once wrote, people love God the way a peasant loves his cow for the milk and the cheese he produces. So one question we have to ask ourselves, why is it we worship God? Why are we here? We come together on Sabbath morning for corporate what? Worship. Have we worshiped God today? Has anybody ever asked you why? Why do we worship God? Why are we here? Is it because we've received earthly blessings? How many here are earthly blessed? I'm earthly blessed. Okay. Is it because of that? Are we proving Satan right? Because I know for a fact he didn't say, have you considered my servant Greg? Because Satan wouldn't have even had to come to the planet and touch anything that I had. Because a lot of the time I live on that milk and cheese level. What do we tell others about why we follow God? The wisest man who ever lived says this, at the end of his memoir, if you will, at the end of his confession, which I really believe that Solomon's, that Ecclesiastes is Solomon's confession of his entire life. He's confessing before God. And at the very end, he says this, the conclusion, when all has been heard, is fear God and keep his commandments, because this applies to every person. You know what's amazing about this? Is that Ecclesiastes, like I said, lays out exactly everything that I've done wrong. Solomon bears his soul and his heart for the reader. And we've heard the legends about Solomon. We've heard, and I bet I've sat in Sabbath schools where we've discussed whether or not Solomon will even be in the kingdom. I believe he will be. You know why? Because of Ecclesiastes. Because he confessed his sins before God. And the amazing thing that he does is that when he lays it all out, I mean, the Ecclesiastes is just this entire book where he says, I thought I could be different. When I was king, I thought I could be different. And I ended up only doing what everyone else had done. I enslaved people. The power went to my head. I wanted wisdom, and the wisdom went completely to my head. I really believe that wisdom could make a difference. I'll tell you one theme of Ecclesiastes is he's telling, look, wisdom does not trump nature. He said, my nature trumped everything. I was given wisdom by God, and it trumped it all. And I did everything the opposite. I did everything that a nasty, earthly, despot king would do. And I thought I could make a difference. He lays it all out there. And then at the end, he says, you know what? As bad as I've been, and we've heard stories about Solomon, he says, I'm still going to lay it at the feet of God. And I'm going to let God do whatever God is going to do. If we confess our sins, he who is faithful and true will forgive us our sins and cleanse us of all unrighteousness. Isn't that what Solomon did in the book of Ecclesiastes? And at the end, he just says, you know what? Fear God. Do it now, he says. It's very encouraging to me that a man like Solomon could say this at the end of his life. He's truly, truly trusting God. Let me ask you this, though. Does Solomon say this in order for you, or does he tell us, look, do this and all will go well with you? Do this and everything is going to be okay. You'll have wisdom, you'll have money, you'll have riches, you'll be cared for, you'll never get sick. Is that what he said? No. Because he begins this chapter to tell us to remember God while we're young. You know why? He said, because getting old is not for sissies. This really stinks. He says, a time is coming when the years draw near and the sun and the moon and the stars are darkened. Clouds will rain. Strong men are bent. Women get tired. Sight dims. Daughters are brought low. Heights are feared. Terrors in the road come. Death comes. Morning comes. The grasshopper drags himself along. He's a poet, but what did he just say? Getting old really, really stinks. But sometimes we tell people, look, just come to God. Just do what God asks you to do and everything will be okay. Don't we? First evangelistic series I ever went to told me that this church and its ways and the Lord of this church was going to make sure that I would never, ever hurt again. That my life would be so simple, that I would be so happy. And I like to tell people, you know what? My life didn't become complicated till after I met Jesus. My life was real uncomplicated before I met Jesus. Living for yourself is easy. Then he showed up. We got to quit telling people that it's going to be okay. We're still going to get old. We're still going to suffer. We're still going to suffer loss. We're going to mourn. We're going to suffer pain. But after you come to Jesus, it's not so much that you know he's going to do something about it. It's having the God who created you in your midst and presence while you suffer and while you have pain. And he doesn't sit on the throne and merely observe. He doesn't sit on the throne and say, you know what? I'm with you, man. I'm with you. But I'm going to stay back here. No, he walked that road for me. He walked that road ahead of me. But sometimes we make it sound like these divine investments like this will always pay earthly dividends. And we use scripture to defend it. What one way have we always told people? That whenever you do it, you will always receive an earthly blessing? What? Pay your tithe. That's right. And what verse do we use? Bring the whole tithe into the storehouse, that there may be food in my house, and test me now in this, says the Lord of hosts. If I will not open for you the windows of heaven and pour out for you a blessing until it overflows. It's So we teach people, pay your tithe and everything is going to be okay. Is it true? No. This is true. Doesn't mean that scripture is not true. What you have to do for somebody before you tell them that, though, is define blessing. Because notice, he said this is a heavenly blessing, not an earthly one. It's a heavenly one. And who's in charge of heavenly blessings? God is. This young couple that I baptized, and they lived awfully far away. Boy, they lived in the wilderness, and I still don't know how they made it, because his work was part time. He was a self-employed contractor. Sweetest couple, three beautiful little girls, but man, it had to be tough. He would drive. You had to go from their house. You had to drive 45 miles on a dirt road in order to get even to the city limits of where we were. And he'd been in the church about a year, and came to me just absolutely broken. He said he never ever wanted to do this, but he was wondering if the church could help him and his wife out. And I said, well, I, as with most churches, I don't make that decision myself. I said, but I've got a few people who sit on this fund, and let me talk to them. And so we did, and we helped them out. And this well-meaning elder, an elder in the church, went to him. And without even asking him, gave him a Bible study on paying tithe. Reason being is the elder really believed that he couldn't have been paying tithe because he was having trouble financially. He truly believed that. Guess what? The young couple paid tithe even before they joined the church. But sometimes that's how we make it sound, right? But we forget to tell people that Malachi says it's an earthly blessing. I mean, it's a heavenly blessing, not an earthly one. And sometimes tithe payers, it doesn't work out. Why do we believe that? Why do we tell people that? Because it's easy. It's easy to do. Plus, Adventists, Morris Vinden said, we believe it because everybody had this one uncle who would tell us this story. Remember? That uncle would tell us the story that the tithe-paying farmer, his field was always okay. And the locusts would destroy every other farm, but not the tithe-paying farmer. Every Adventist had an uncle who told them that. Right? You guys are all smiling, right? Uncle Arthur told us that, right? In story after story after story. Elder Vinden said that he had a church member who was the only tithe-paying farmer, and the locusts only destroyed his field one time and left all the others alone. And he said, well, how do you feel about that? And he said, well, if God wanted to destroy his crops with his creatures and feed them, who am I to say so? We forget, though, that the context of Malachi 3 goes back to the beginning, and he says, but who can endure his coming? Who can stand when he appears? For he's like a refiner's fire and like fuller's soap. I never understood what fuller's soap, but it's a laundryman. This is what professionals would use. Can you imagine what ancient soap looked like? And my great-grandmother used lye to clean our clothes, to clean my grandmother's clothes. But that's what it's caustic, a refiner's fire too. It's fire. And he says, he'll sit as a smelter and purifier of silver. He will purify the sons of Levi and refine them like gold and silver so that they may present to the Lord offerings in righteousness. It isn't paying tithe that does this for them. It's the refining of suffering and living on this planet. And it also is sometimes maybe the earthly unblessing that paying your tithe might bring about. Because sometimes paying your tithe means that that bill doesn't get paid. But these acts of righteousness brought out by trial and tribulation and refining and suffering, it isn't strengthened by paying your tithe in order to receive a financial blessing. we present our offerings to God with joy and willingness, and even when there's no earthly reason to do so. And we know that there's no earthly reason to do so, because sometimes we make it sound like God needs our money. Does he? No. See, that's the thing, is that Job has figured this out somehow. Don't know how he did it, but he's figured it out. It's why he is what he is. It's why I said last week, he's probably the finest that humanity has to offer when it comes to creatures worshiping God. Because not only can he do it without any earthly blessings anymore, he can now even do it even though he holds God personally responsible for doing this. When we get into his conversations and what he says to God, there's actually a verse where he says, "Who are you, O watcher of man? Who are you? Why am I such a blip on your radar? Can't you leave me alone just long enough for me to even gather spit in my mouth?" He says that to God. And yet he worships him at the same time. So to worship God when it doesn't hurt, or when it doesn't cost, or when we don't suffer, we could be standing with the accuser, thinking we were on the right side and realizing that maybe not. So every time I read the book of Job, I try to check my motive constantly. Constantly check my motive. And we all need to too. What would we do if it was all taken away? Could we actually say, "Blessed be the name of the Lord"? I don't know. So, he accuses God of not being worthy of worship. That's what he accuses him of. He accuses God of manipulating Job's worship. He accuses him because he says, "You know what? You really know in your heart of hearts that nobody really wants to worship you, so you fixed the game." By the way, that accusation, can anybody worship you for nothing? That accusation right there is the heart of the great controversy. That is the heart of the great controversy right there. That one question to be resolved. By the way, guess who besides Job in this particular case, but I don't know what Job would be likened, but in the great controversy, the answer is yes. You know why? Because Jesus did. Jesus still worshiped the Father when every earthly blessing was taken away. Jesus went to the cross to make sure that the answer, "Does Job serve God for nothing," would be no. Jesus, because of who he did and what he's done for us, takes all of our selfish motives to the cross and answers Satan, answers the accusation. Yes, humanity can do so because I did. He who knew no sin became sin, so that in him we might become the righteousness of God. Jesus is the only answer to that question. Jesus is the only answer to the great controversy. So this is what he tells God. But then he begins to accuse Job on another level too. Because when Job proclaims that he's still worshiping God, even to the point that his wife is exhausted and exasperated that he still is, and we are absolutely exasperated that he's still able to, Satan's not done. He comes back to God. And I love that God asks him again, "Where'd you come from?" Let him know. Let him know. If I don't, he's going to think he owns the place. Satan answered, "Roaming about on the earth, walking to and fro." Satan's always hoping that God doesn't really notice Job and that it didn't work. Okay. So if you consider Job, no one like him. Blameless, upright, man-fearing God, turning away from evil. He still holds fast his integrity, although you incited me against him to ruin him without cause. He stands to the accusation, he says. What more do you want? Satan says, "Skin for skin. All that a man has, he will give for his life. However, put forth your hand now and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will curse you to your face." Yeah, Job passed the first test. Everything that didn't affect him personally, physically, now touch him. Now take the one thing he's got left, his health. Now take it. His health, his well-being. So the adversary now begins to accuse Job. He accuses Job, and I want you to notice, he doesn't accuse Job of doing his sacrifices wrong. He doesn't accuse Job of praying wrong. He doesn't accuse Job of worshiping wrong. There's nothing wrong with how he's worshiping. What he's doing is he's questioning Job's motive. He's questioning Job as to why he does it. He didn't speak to him, but that's exactly what he's saying to him. I don't think you serve God for nothing. I think you serve Him for the wrong reasons. You serve Him for what He can give you. He's questioning the only thing that separates the godly from the satanic. This is how strongly I feel about this. The one thing that separates the godly from the satanic is that question right there, and whether or not we're willing to cross that line and question somebody's motive. Motive is the only thing that separates the truly righteous from the unrighteous, or even the righteous looking. See, sometimes we think it's our religious behavior that separates us from the wicked. Our law keeping, our Sabbath keeping, our feasting, our health message, trying to love our neighbor as ourselves. But sometimes religious behavior may tell us a lot or tell us nothing about what's going on inside a person's head and heart. Right? In fact, some people that have it going on outside and look to see to have it most together, sometimes you sit them down and you find out they're falling apart. Religious behavior may tell us nothing about what a person's motive is. Jesus taught us that. In the Sermon on the Mount, he taught that he came to abolish, not to abolish the law, but to fulfill. In fact, heaven and earth pass away before one stroke of the law does. So will a righteous person be a law keeper? They'll at least appear to do that. Whoever annuls the one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever keeps and teaches them, he shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. And then he goes on and he names some commandments. Adultery, murder, so forth and so on. He says, yes, at least they'll be able to do this. But the law, the letter of the law, is only the beginning. And the letter of the law, as we studied for 8 weeks, cannot bring about righteousness. But at least we should be able to do the skeleton, the bare minimum of the law. If I can't love my neighbor as myself, at least I can restrain from killing them. But he says the problem with law keeping as a standard of righteousness, it can be used to only appear righteous. Because in the same chapter he then says, for I say to you that unless your righteousness surpasses that of the scribes and the Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. So there are two ways for our righteousness to exceed that of the self-proclaimed righteousness of the Pharisees and the scribes. Number one, the letter of the law is only the beginning. Concrete examples, murder, adultery, divorce, it's a skeleton, it's a starting point. Spirit takes you where? Spirit takes you deeper. Jesus says, consider this. Yeah, you shouldn't kill. But let me tell you this. If you're even angry with your brother, you've murdered him in your heart. Spirit takes us deeper. Pharisees don't like Jesus because he takes the law where it never, ever imagined it could go. To where? To the heart. And the only other way for our righteousness to exceed is motive, or whether or not we will question somebody's motive, or the motive why we do what we do and why we don't do what we don't do. Because after that, he tells us how to practice our piety. Give, pray, fast. He says, look, the unrighteous do these things. They give, they pray, and they fast. The same behavior is exhibited in both groups. The difference will be motive. He says, the unrighteous have an impure motive. They do it in order to be seen by men or to find favor with God. They said, when you pray, don't pray up, don't heap up empty phrases. Don't try to be eloquent. Don't try to think that you can talk God in or out of anything. He says the pagans do that with their gods. They try to manipulate him. They think they will be heard because of their many words. He says, but you, let your yes be yes, let your no be no. Just talk to him. You can't do it to find, your behavior is not going to find you favor with God. Why? Because a righteous person knows that he is already favored by God. He said the other reason you don't do it is to find favor with men. You don't do it to look good in front of someone else. The Pharisees used to give and pray publicly. And people used to look at them and just be in awe of their piety and believe that their spirituality was just so deep. He says, if that's your reason for doing it, congratulations, you have your reward. But the ones with pure hearts, the ones with the right motive, the ones that know that God loves them, and their prayer and their spiritual life and their worship and their piety and their sanctity and their sanctification doesn't buy any more favor with God. And they don't do it to look good in front of someone else. Blessed are the pure in heart. That's what that means. I do these things, and I don't do certain things, but I do it for the right motive. And the right motive, the only right motive for a Christian, is selfless. Don't let your right hand know what your left hand... Do all those scriptures become clearer when we understand that's what he's saying? The right motive. And we don't question someone else's motive. That's why you stand in a church and warn of Satanism. Because you know where the Bible says we can find that which is truly satanic? Do you know where we find it? There are two churches in Revelation that receive no rebuke from Jesus. Every other one receives a rebuke. There's one church that receives nothing kind to say. But every other church normally receives something good and one thing that he has against them. But there are two churches that he has absolutely nothing against them. The first one is in Smyrna. The first one comes in Smyrna earlier or later in chapter 2. Jesus commends them by telling them that he knows their affliction. He knows their suffering. And he knows that slander comes on them from those who say they are Jews, but actually are from the synagogue of Satan. The church, that which is truly satanic, doesn't come from the world. It comes from the church. A church who acts like Satan. He accuses them. He slanders them. And Smyrna has received no rebuke because they stand up to that. They can still be a pure church, even though the church accuses them of things. Accuses them of things, of why they do what they do. Does the church serve God for nothing? And here you have a church that's going through affliction and not questioning it about whether or not they should be worshiping God. The church is truly Job-like. Right? Satanic activity is not coming from some witch's coven or some bar or some club or a rock concert with pentagrams or a theater showing a Harry Potter movie. It comes from someone claiming to be a Jew, a true son of God, someone who claims to be churched. Someone who claims to be a follower of Jesus yet questions the motive of another is dangerous. I believe that's all we need to be satanic. Question somebody's motive for why they are doing what they are doing. I've used this example in prayer meeting and everywhere before, and it's kind of a superficial example, but maybe you'll understand what I'm saying. Do Seventh-day Adventists as a whole, let's say just this congregation, do all the Seventh-day Adventists here agree on how Sabbath should be kept? We don't, do we? Okay, and generally you have a group of people that think it's okay to do X on the Sabbath, and I am not going to define X, okay? And then you have a group of people that say it's not okay to do X on the Sabbath. Now, by observing, what do we know about those people? I look at my brother and all I know is that he feels it's okay to do X on the Sabbath. That's all I know, right? And that's all I'm given to know. I don't know his heart. I don't know his what? I don't know his motive. And he looks at me and he obviously by my behavior sees that I don't believe it's okay to do X on the Sabbath. But he doesn't know my heart. He doesn't know my what? He doesn't know my motive. See, and I don't leave it there. I look at Grady and I go, he's just using grace as an excuse to sin. He's sinning so grace may abound. What did I just do? I questioned his motive. I just became what? Satanic. And then Grady looks at me, and all he knows is that I don't think it's okay to do X on the Sabbath. Grady doesn't leave it there. What does he do? Pharisee. Legalist. What'd you just do? Question my motive. Why do we do it? Because it's the easiest thing to do. We do it because of lack of faith. We do it because of lack of love. I would rather stand and accuse you than love you, because loving you is hard. And letting you get away with whatever I think that you're getting away with is what a loving person could do, but it doesn't buy me anything. You know, it doesn't make me look good. See, I believe I'm better off with God than you are. And if I love you and let that go and not question your motive, then guess what? I don't look as good. You see how quickly it happens, how quickly it comes? Because I know everybody here, at one time or another, has questioned someone else's motive. And the sad thing is that we do it right here in church. We do it with people who disagree with us. We've been doing it for years now. I won't speak for you. I've been doing it for years now, looking at another group and how they feel about how the world church should be run. And I question their motive every day. And you know what? It's satanic. The next time that the synagogue of Satan is mentioned is in our scripture reading, Grady, in the Church of Philadelphia. Jesus said, you know what? Everybody, though, everybody in the synagogue of Satan, you know where I'll take them? I'm going to take them to Philadelphia, and I'm going to put them at your feet. Because when they see you, they will know that I loved you. Philadelphia has nothing bad said about it because it's a church of love. The thing about Philadelphia, it says, you have no power. There's no power. You don't have any money. You don't have any power. And yet you love me. You have opened up the door. You are, and your worship is, truly Job-like. You know, if you buy into the prophetic interpretation that the churches are eras in Christian history, which I think it works, and I also think it works to look at it the other way too, that these were all real churches with real problems, and at any given time, any modern church can be like any other of the seven churches. But if you buy into the era, which I do, Philadelphia comes at the second great awakening. Philadelphia comes where the church says, you know what? Up until now, in the Middle Ages, the church relied on political power, it relied on money, it relied on armies, it relied on all these things. Philadelphia turns it on its head, and the Second Great Awakening happens, even though the church has no political power, and it has no money. And our own church was born in that movement. They're Job-like churches. And as they try to carry out their Job-like mission, they have a church or a synagogue that claims to be a church, but actually is a synagogue of Satan, questioning their motives. So here Job sits, all earthly blessings removed, his family, his health, his wealth, suffering what most of us can only imagine, and he cries into the air, and there is no answer. Silence not brought by an uncaring God, but by an accusation that can't be proven. And this is probably the most insidious thing of Satan or anybody questioning anybody's motive, is that once I question your motive, you can't prove or disprove it. So what do? We just sit back and then wait for it to happen. And in the meantime, we don't talk about what it does to our relationships as we sit back and let it happen. Satan accuses Job. You worship him for the wrong reason. And here I am to prove it. You should just curse him and die. But Satan can't prove it. He can't prove it. I can't prove your motive, and you can't prove mine. And yet we allow that to be the motive of our fellowship. Silence. Not being honest about who we are. Silence not by an uncaring God, but by an accusation that can't be proven. The accuser watches with narrow eyes, looking for the proof. See, once I accuse you of your motive, then I'm gonna sit and I'm gonna wait and I'm gonna narrow my eyes and I'm gonna wait for the proof. So we got members sitting in our church, sitting here right now, suffering. You know why? You know why? Because life is hard. Life's hard. It's hard to live like others. And there are lonely people sitting in our congregation who look at the rest of us and say, I don't know what they're doing, but they look so perfect. And here I am struggling. I must be the only sinner in this entire place. No help comes, no honesty comes, because all eyes are narrowed looking for proof that their motive is impure. And we look at those who struggle, and we look at those who can't seem to do what we want them to do or what we think they should be doing in a church. And we say, they just want to sin. They don't want to get any better. They want to sin so grace may abound. And we look at others and we say, they just want to buy their way to heaven. They just want to deserve grace when it comes to them. Meanwhile, we all sit and we mourn and we die. I, for one, pray to Jesus that he would take us to the feet of those who worship in Philadelphia and put us there right now. I'm tired of being Laodicea. See, Laodicea is the next one that comes. And from history, guess who's Laodicea? We are. And that door that Philadelphia opened, that door that proves to the world that the church can worship God, even though they don't have any money, they don't have any power, they don't have any wealth, they don't have any health, that door was wide open. And he said, that door no one can ever shut. Yet Laodicea shut the door and shut it tight, and they shut Jesus on the other side of it. Because the end time church can't get past this. The end time church can't seem to get past this. I am rich and I have need of nothing. And I certainly don't need a better understanding of grace. I already understand grace. I already understand righteousness by faith. I already understand the three angels' message. I already understand all these things. And we don't notice that that door that Philadelphia opened has now been shut. And we rely way too much, on our wealth and on our health. Sometimes we act way too much like the accuser rather than a lover of the brethren, which literally is what Philadelphia means. So I'm not saying we got to go back to reform. I don't think going back to reform means that you're supposed to go back to reform. Usually when we go back, it means we're going to go back and make the same mistakes again. I want to move forward to Philadelphia. Because Jesus said that he would take everyone in that synagogue and he would put them at Philadelphia's feet. Because when we watch them, when we know them, watch them. No power, no love. I mean, no power, no wealth, but nothing but love. And they changed the world. Second Great Awakening changed the world. It gave birth to our own church. It gave birth to dozens of them, all come out of this era. Adventism wouldn't have existed had it not come during the Second Great Awakening. Do you agree with that, historians? Philadelphia. Does Job serve God for nothing? Question to ponder all week.